More sunny day flooding and stronger hurricanes.
Storm surges, hotter days, and more of them.
A national climate assessment warns the impacts of our warming planet have already come to the Sunshine State.
This is the Florida Roundup from WLRN Public Media in Miami and WJCT Public Broadcasting in Jacksonville. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. Well, this week, the climate risk here in Florida. A new federal report says climate change is already affecting us and that the risks are growing. So what's at stake? What about the decades ahead, the costs, and maybe the opportunities? Meantime, three Florida representatives join a bipartisan effort to put a price on carbon emissions.
We got a lot to talk about today when it comes to climate and the Sunshine State. You can join the conversation statewide at 305-995-1800 or join us on Twitter at Florida Roundup. It's next after the news. Welcome to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, a week ago, a federal government report was issued on climate change, and it was a dire report. It warned that Americans are already experiencing the effects of a warming planet and predicts that the risk will continue growing. Now, this is of great interest to the entire world, but it's especially of interest to all of us here in Florida. A hot state with a lot of coastal property. So there's great interest about this report here in the Sunshine State.
Absolutely. It's the fourth national climate assessment, Melissa. It says stronger storms, higher seas, and warmer temperatures already are affecting communities, including those here in Florida. Sunny day flooding is happening. Higher storm surges are a reality. And higher temperatures are here today, now, for Florida. And the report warns all of this is going to continue, costing billions of dollars in the future, threatening lives and livelihoods. Now, President Trump was asked about this week. He was asked about the predicted economic costs from climate change.
No, I don't believe it. And here's the other thing. You're going to have China and Japan and all of Asia and all of these other countries, you know, addresses our country. Right now, we're at the cleanest we've ever been. And that's very important to me. But if we're clean, but every other place on Earth is dirty, that's not so good.
Keep in mind, this is a government report issued by the Trump administration that the president is discounting. Just today, a new statement out from the Union of Concerned Scientists criticizing President Trump for trying to discredit a report his own administration release that shows that climate change is already taking a toll on the U.S. with impacts happening in every part of this country. So what is at stake for the nation and for Florida? Not just right now where we're already experiencing these impacts, but in the decades to come. What are the costs, the potential costs to Florida? Everything from managing sea level rise and potentially managed retreats away from coastlines. We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars potentially in lost residential and business property. At the same time, what are the opportunities as we seek to adapt to a warming planet and to rising seas? We're going to spend the full hour today on the Florida Roundup, taking your calls statewide as we discuss this climate assessment. And the number to join us is 305-995-1800. Give us a call or tweet us right now at Florida Roundup. As kicking off the discussion from the WLRN studios, we're pleased to welcome Dr. Ben Kurtman. He's a professor at the University of Miami's Rosenstiel School for Marine and Atmospheric Science. Dr. Kurtman, a pleasure to have you on the Florida Roundup. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me here. I really appreciate it.
Again, 305-995-1800 to join the show statewide. And let's begin, Dr. Kurtman, by explaining just what is the National Climate Assessment. This is something that the government is required to put out. Can you tell us a little bit more about the government's backing of this report and why this is mandated, why this information must be distributed to the nation?
So federal law was passed, I believe, in the 1990s, requires that the United States government issue a report every 4 years on the state of the climate system as relevant to the United States. The assessment process is to look at what is the best available science telling us what the climate looks over the U.S. and how that might affect transportation, economies, agriculture, whether that be in the marine environment or on land, water resources, all the entire spectrum of climate-related industrial usage issues and things like that. The report is run by what's called the U.S. Global Change Research Program. The assessment involves both U.S. Global Change Research scientists from USGCRP, but NOAA scientists, NASA scientists, DOE, the whole spectrum, and a few from the academic world.
It was notable that the Trump administration put this information out on Black Friday, critics said, as a way to perhaps downplay its findings, because the findings are pretty stark. It did not prevent widespread discussion and media attention of this report. And let's talk about some of the most eye-popping findings, Doctor. Across the country, people can assess the impacts to their part of the world. For example, in the Southwest and in the Plain States, they're going to be dealing with more wildfires. Here in the Southeast, we're going to be dealing with even more extreme heat and sea level rise. But those aren't the only impacts for Florida, are they? Can you share a little bit more about what we can expect here in Florida if nothing is done to slow carbon emissions and cool the planet down a little bit, at least try to get close to the targets that were mandated in that 2015 Paris Agreement on climate?
Sure. So first, I want to emphasize that this is part two of the fourth National Climate Assessment. Part one primarily focuses on the physical environment, you know, what's happening to the climate system itself. This part two focuses primarily on what are the impacts. And in terms of the impacts, one of the things that stands out, at least in the Southeast and particularly in Florida, is the number of warm nights. And what we're seeing is at least a 50% increase in the number of warm nights. And at first, you might sort of say, well, what's the big deal about warm nights? You know, who cares? Well, warm nights have an agricultural impact. It affects the growing season. Warm nights affect the distribution of mosquito and therefore mosquito-borne diseases. Warm nights, you know, the communities that, you know, typically open their windows at night because they can't afford to run air conditioning 24/7, that very much affects them. And, of course, there's this positive feedback. When you have many more warm nights, there's more energy usage to cool your home, to cool buildings, and that has, again, a positive feedback on climate change because that produces more carbon emissions. And then we're going to see increases in energy costs also. So we're seeing a 10 to 15% increase in energy costs. So just that one simple thing, the number of warm nights, has a profound impact throughout the state of Florida. And then when you start to look at maybe some of the marine environment issues, coral bleaching, you know, the Florida reef track is perhaps one of the most important, if not the only major reef track in the continental United States. It's a tremendous importance for tourism, fisheries, and that reef traffic is being seriously challenged by the warming oceans and the ocean acidification. So there are many, many things that are going on, and you really have to look at this sort of holistically about the challenges to the state of Florida across the entire spectrum of tourism. Mm-hmm. Whatever it is, transportation,
property values,
all
insurability,
things.
All of that. When talking about the vulnerabilities in the southeastern United States and Florida, storm surges, mosquito-borne illnesses, hotter nights and hotter days, as you discuss the issues of acidification of the ocean and putting the coral reef at risk, which allows storm surges to get even bigger along continental coast. The White House spokeswoman Sarah Sanders on Tuesday, when asked to comment about this report, said that it was based on the worst case scenarios. Is that true?
I think I would push back on that a little bit. And you have to remember that when these reports are prepared, they're really consensus documents. So when one of these reports produces a statement of fact, it's a consensus statement based on multiple lines of evidence from disparate studies involving different scientists with, you know, different views of the world and different views of how things work. So they're actually pretty conservative statements.
But what about the science? Is the science, though, the worst case scenario? Occasionally have a range of outcomes.
It does, and I think this report is pretty well balanced in identifying best case scenarios and worst case scenarios. They talk about intermediate sea level rise, but when you look at the current trajectory that we're on, This report is pretty balanced in identifying that we are on a trajectory at this moment in time that the impacts are quite severe.
Speaking with Dr. Ben Kirtman, professor at the University of Miami's Rosenstiel School for Marine and Atmospheric Science, the White House also said, quote, our focus is on making sure we have the safest, cleanest air and water. Again, when they were asked about the climate change assessment, the conversation the White House transferred to was clean air and clean water. And you heard the president mention that in the soundbite that we played at the top of the program.
Sure. And I'm sure that's that clean air and clean water, of course, is important to me, is important to everybody else. So that's certainly part of the issue. But I think that's, conflating things that aren't necessarily directly related. When we really think about climate change, we're thinking about how greenhouse gas emissions are warming the planet and what the impacts are of those of that warming and the increase in the greenhouse gas emissions. Clean water and clean air is of course related. Water resources are going to be connected to the changing climate, but it's not that direct connect. And I think they're sort of conflating things. And I would also add that, you know, putting methane and CO2 into the atmosphere is a kind of pollution of the air, and we should be thinking about that.
Not to mention it increases wildfires, which in the West in particular, we've been seeing so much of that in recent years, which deteriorates air quality in Western and Southwestern states as well.
Oh, absolutely. My family still lives in Southern California, and the air quality, they're a little bit older, and air quality was a big issue for them, and they had to evacuate where they live just because of the air quality conditions. So it's a big issue.
And it's 305-995-1800 statewide this noon hour on the Florida Roundup as we spend the full hour today discussing the National Climate Assessment and what we can expect here in Florida as we speak with scientists, journalists, and you, the listeners. Give us a call right now. Let us know what your thoughts and concerns are about climate change in Florida. Let's begin with Eric in Jacksonville. Hey, Eric, you're on the air. How are you doing? Go ahead.
I'm doing well. Thanks for taking my call. I'm going to make a point about building zoning and building and what we should do. But before I do that, I want to make a quick comment about the president. The president has proved that he doesn't even really understand, and your guest just pointed this out, not directly, but I don't think the president even understands the science. And the science is really simple for the listeners, for people that are listening. CO2 is a greenhouse gas. Greenhouse gases absorb heat. Therefore, the more greenhouse gases there are in the atmosphere, the hotter the planet gets. Mm-hmm. That's the science. That is not complicated. That is not complex. That's something you can teach junior high school kids. And the fact that
I get your point, Eric. It is remarkable to see the president disavowing his own administration's scientific consensus. But I think you had a question too about how Florida will deal with building on the coast in the coming decades.
Okay.
Correct.
Yes, I've lived in Florida for off and on for 50 years, and I've never seen the St. Johns River at the levels that it was and stayed at long after with the tide and everything. Even after those storms came through, it stayed very high for a very long period of time. And across the street over here off Roosevelt Boulevard, there was a parking lot that was completely flooded. The St. Johns River had flooded all the way up into this parking lot, and people were riding around in boats in this parking lot. Now, after the water subsided, they tore down. There was a Belk building that had been there for a long time, the Roosevelt Mall. They tore it down, mm-hmm. and now they've got a sign up that says they're going to build another building right where that building was.
Mm-hmm. I get your point. Okay. Is Florida just going to keep going down this same path of beach renourishment, rapid rebuild? Business as usual, in other words, Eric, I think is what you're getting at, right? Rather than take a deep dive and look at the way we code, the way we build, the way we look at sustainability and mitigation. So that's Eric in Jacksonville, and I think that's really at the heart of the matter, Dr. Kirtman. How much longer can Florida afford to literally and figuratively bury our heads in the sand that we keep renourishing our beaches with as the water comes in? At what point does Florida get serious about this? At what point does the rubber meet the road? Is it when actuaries say, look, the coasts are now uninsurable? And what they will say privately is that day is coming. They don't talk about it publicly so much, but they will say that that day is on the horizon.
Yeah, I do see there is definitely a looming problem. I would say to Eric's comment. I'm starting to see in some of my conversations with at least with local politicians that there's a real interest now in starting to really think about developing some requirements that all changes to, you know, infrastructure, all building codes start to really take the climate change question into account. So I think that's what Eric is really asking for, and I think that's something that has to really start today.
But isn't that different? I think that's different though than saying a moratorium on building along the coastline or moving back or retreating.
Yes.
To say we can build in these locations still, but we're building now 36 inches above base flood level, for instance, that they require in the Florida Keys. We are requiring washaway first or second floors. The first inhabitable floor has to be on the third floor or higher.
Exactly.
Those types of things. Reinforced concrete that can withstand saltwater intrusion.
Exactly. That's the personally, I'm not opposed to development and in enhancing infrastructure. I think it's important that what we do decide to build and how we build it takes a long view of what the climate system is going to look like, what sea level rise is going to look like.
305-995-1800, talking about the climate assessment as it relates to Florida. Nolly in Miami on line 6. Nolly, you're on the radio. Go ahead.
Hi there. I was calling because climate is such a global issue and there are no borders relating, but I wanted to know what the comparison is there are in this report pertaining to other countries or other areas so we can have a point of comparison and a better understanding.
Very good. This is a report that came from the U.S. government. It was focused on the United States, but there are some regional aspects in there, including the Caribbean has its own chapter, Doctor.
Yeah. This certainly looks at U.S. interests abroad, of course, the economic impacts abroad. It has chapters on the Caribbean. The Caribbean is severely challenged by sea level rise and water, access to fresh water. If we look at stabilizing the climate at 2 degrees, many Caribbean and Pacific Island nations will be underwater.
That's 2 degrees Celsius.
Two degrees Celsius. I'm sorry. So right. Maybe something like 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit, something on the order of that. So that's, if you recall from the Paris Accords, it was 2 degrees or less. So, hopefully less. But that 2 degree target is probably unsustainable for many nations in the Caribbean.
Isn't that the growing consensus, Doctor, that 2 degree target, we're probably going to overshoot the target as a planet? We are not going to meet the Paris goal.
Yeah,
that is the consensus that seems to be forming around researchers and scientists and professors such as yourself.
Yes. So the way there was a recent UN IPCC report that is titled something like 1.5 degrees. Basically, that report has one key statement. And that key statement to start out with is if we completely stopped emitting CO2 today, we would probably be able to stabilize the climate at 1.5 degrees.
A lot of hypotheticals.
That's
in
a
there.
Lot of hypotheticals. Yeah. So what that tells you is that stabilizing the climate at 1.5 degrees, let alone 2 degrees, is an enormous challenge. But if we start getting very serious about biting off that 2 degree stabilization, we will overshoot. There's no question we will overshoot. But there are scenarios where we overshoot and return to about 1.5 to 1.75 degrees. So it can
be
done.
You're saying it can be done, but it would require an enormous heavy lift around the globe of radically disrupting the way we do business. And certainly we're not seeing the political will in this country to do that. Or the state, which we will continue to talk about this hour. We're at the same time, we're seeing protests all over the globe as the reports get more and more dire, the activists stopping traffic in big overseas cities like London, a movement called Extinction Rebellion, demanding that the world get serious about climate change. Here in Florida, certainly out of all 50 states, we are the state that needs to be extremely concerned about this. We're going to continue through the hour here on the show, taking your calls and tweets about the climate assessment, already getting your tweets Here's one from Lane saying, let's be smart and listen to this assessment. As we continue talking about this, we want your calls on the show at 305-995-1800. Have you been following the news about the climate assessment? What are your concerns about how this will be felt in Florida? Not just in the future, but already right now, because it's happening now. We're seeing stronger storms. We're seeing hotter weather. The impacts are here today. Call us up. Your calls and tweets right after this. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami today, talking about the federal government's National Climate Assessment Report. It was released just a week ago on a Black Friday. It warns that the impacts of climate change already are being felt across the country. Here in Florida, it means hotter weather. And in South Florida, at least, year-round mosquitoes.
Not what you want to hear.
No.
Now, a separate report, for you, Tom, especially, you're in South Florida. I'm up here in North Florida, I'm sure we'll be getting those mosquitoes as well. Now, a separate report from the researcher group Climate Central has found that over the past five decades, several Florida cities, from Miami to Tallahassee, Tampa to Jacksonville, well, they've all experienced a growing number of days with high temperatures above 95 degrees. People around the state could probably have already told you that just from living through it. Lieutenant Governor-elect Jeanette Nunez this week said the incoming administration of Governor-elect Ron DeSantis will focus on the environment.
What I'll tell you is at the state level, we're committed, and Ron is committed, to making sure that we're addressing environmental issues that are specific here to Florida. And so what he said is he wants to make sure that he's appointing the best, most qualified individuals that have accurate information, that have the science background, that have the knowledge and the know-how to address issues that are important for us here.
Now, that was this week. In 2014, then-Congressman Ron DeSantis told a crowd in Daytona Beach solutions offered to address climate change, in his estimation, boil down to just one thing.
The answer is basically raise taxes. And so what that will do is that will create a huge amount of economic pain. It'll hurt low and middle income people disproportionately. And what will the result be? Nobody has seriously argued that it would save the planet or we'd have no more problems. Nobody's argued that. So you're talking about, you're basically going to have a minute change at best in your emissions for a huge cost.
So will Ron DeSantis change his approach as governor from the tone he struck on climate as a congressman? And here's another question. How is your part of Florida responding to the impacts of climate change? How are different regions of the state dealing with the impacts climate change is expected to bring? Give us a call as we continue the conversation here on the Florida Roundup at 305-995-1800. Tweet us at Florida Roundup. Still with us, Dr. Ben Kurtman. He's a professor at the University of Miami's Rosenstiel School for Marine and Atmospheric Science. And also now with us in studio, WLRN's environmental reporter, Kate Stein, and the environmental reporter from WMFE in Orlando, Amy Green. Kate, Amy, great to have you both with us on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Nice to talk with you.
Okay, Kate, let's start with you. You know, I think Southeast Florida is the part of the state that has gotten the most religion on climate. There's this Southeast Florida Regional Climate Compact happening in Southeast Florida, has been for years. There's a bipartisan leadership group of officials really working on mitigation and adaptation measures. I suppose because once the water is regularly coming in, people tend to get more pragmatic about solutions. And so how is this report being received in South Florida? Tell us about the efforts in South Florida to deal with sea level rise and some of these other impacts.
Well, I don't think that there were exactly a lot of surprises in this report for South Florida. I mean, obviously, sea level rise has long been a huge issue here. There was a lot in this report about heat and heat impacts to farming and agriculture, and then also the economic impacts of things like intensifying hurricanes and how that can kind of ripple through the system and, you know, cause a lot of disruption in a region. And so I think that the report itself wasn't that new, and the response is just, you know, more kind of more alarm bells going off, more urgency for things like the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Change Compact, which is a coalition among the four South Florida counties to work on different adaptation and mitigation strategies, as you mentioned, Melissa, things like learning about, you know, what strategies can we share on best practices for protecting our cities against king tide flooding, for example, things like that. I think that one big takeaway for me was the heat in particular. That's something that we don't always hear a lot about down here. And just, you know, we talked about more 95 plus degree days. This report says that that could become the norm for South Florida in the really not so distant future. And that has impacts, you know, on people who work outdoors, construction workers, agricultural workers, that can make, you know, crop growth less productive. It can make it impossible to grow crops in the day. And if you think during the day, and if you think about places like Homestead or, you know, some of our agricultural areas, that really could have a big economic impact here.
Amy Green, what about for the central part of the state where there is no coastline, but you're going to experience that hot weather and the mosquitoes and perhaps some climate refugees moving away from the coastlines?
There is research supporting that theory that as people become displaced from the coast, that Central Florida is one place where they'll go. And, you know, I had the same takeaway as Kate, you know, just impressed by the heat that is projected to just get hotter here in the southeast, and especially nighttime temperatures, as Dr. Ben Kurtman mentioned earlier in the show. You know, here in the southeast, we're not going to have a nightly cool down in temperatures, and so those hot temperatures are projected to only get hotter. I was on a conference call yesterday with one of the authors of the report, and she said that, you know, as temperatures get hotter, outside workers will be among the most exposed. They'll be needing to take more breaks, and the lost productivity associated with that in the southeast is projected to be $4.7 billion. And that alone is one third of the total estimated cost of lost labor in the United States. And so here in the southeast, those hot temperatures are projected to be especially felt here.
It's 305-995-1800 on the Florida Roundup. Lots of tweets coming into the show. Dr. Kurtman, here's one from Josh. This is an important point often missed by climate skeptics. A small change in temperature can produce large changes in mosquito behavior and thus rates of infectious disease. Doctor, there's sort of a cascading series of effects that are predicted from climate change, and some of them are ancillary or hidden impacts that we might not always think of. Mosquitoes and disease is one of them, as Josh tweets the show. What are some other less obvious impacts that scientists are trying to warn the public about?
Well, I mean, the one that's sort of less obvious that pops up into my mind has to do with our national fisheries. Of course, this is really important for South Florida. For example, associated with climate change, we expect to see an expansion of lionfish. Lionfish are an invasive species that are doing a lot of damage. So there are these things that we expect to have happen that, you know, you just wouldn't normally think about. And in fact, I would argue that, you know, Florida in particular needs to do some of its own assessment directly. What are the impacts that would be most important for Florida in general? You know, we have
so you'd advocate a Florida state climate assessment report?
Yes, definitely. I think that's something I would love to see to come out of the DeSantis administration. I don't know who should necessarily run it, but I think that's something that's really needed. You know, this is a very inhomogeneous topography. Our coastlines are very different. We have agriculture in some regions, urban areas in other. The impact of climate is gonna be very different. And when you look at this most recent report, it covers the whole southeast, and that's a big region. The impacts in Florida are going to be very different, and we might have very different interests than the whole southeast in general. So we need a report that focuses on our local needs.
And we haven't had that. The preceding administration, the Rick Scott administration, was criticized heavily. Its employees in the relevant agencies told, I think, the Miami Herald and other outlets they weren't even allowed to use the term climate change. Here's a tweet about that from Brian. As a resident of what seems to be the most vulnerable state in the union, why isn't the Florida legislature acknowledging and taking action with regard to this imminent threat to our way of life? Kate, Amy, it does not seem as though this climate assessment has put the kind of inexorable pressure on the legislature to force this to the forefront. You know, when we had the massacre at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School, that was so tragic and so horrific. That forced the legislature to act on that issue. What's it going to take for the legislature to act on this issue? Amy, let's start with you.
Well, a lot of people think that what's going to happen is that one of these days we're going to have some kind of calamity, a hurricane, something, and finally people are going to get it. People are going to understand what's happening, and people will start to withdraw from the coast. Investors will start to withdraw from the coast. That will affect coastal economies, and it will go from there. You know, looking back at Hurricane Irma, one of the things the report talked about is the need is infrastructure and the need to focus future building not on past trends, which is what we have historically done, but to focus building and focus infrastructure building on what's projected to happen in the future. The report talked about problems with infrastructure and projected costs to infrastructure as we sustain losses from hurricanes and flooding and these other things. And we sure saw that with Hurricane Irma, with the flooding we experienced with that hurricane, sewage spills, all of those kinds of things.
Kate, we have seen the legislature respond to those moments of cataclysmic danger, a storm, for instance, like Irma, like Michael in the Panhandle, that continues to deal with the aftermath of that, like Hurricane Andrew in 1992, for instance. Whether or not that gets attached to climate change per se has been very difficult, and we've had conversations. It's very difficult, if not impossible, to attribute one storm to climate change. But
right.
I want to go back to the heat assessment in this report, because in Florida, we do talk about sea level rise creeping up. We talk about the increased risk of stronger storms, higher storm surge lasting longer, flooding the area. But the lack of an evening cool down for most of Florida, that is not a cataclysmic weather event that you can necessarily put on the date and remember is August 25th. 1992, which was, of course, the date of Andrew,
right.
or September 10th, 2017, which was Irma. Those heat days build up, or the lack of a cooling night build up year after year.
Yeah, that's a huge deal, and I think it's kind of underappreciated. I mean, already in Florida, I'm working right now on a story about agriculture and heat in Florida and how climate change can impact agriculture here going forward. And it's been really interesting to learn that already some crops, the workers start picking okra, for example, in the middle of the night. They start at 2 or 3 in the morning because it just gets too hot in the middle of the day for them to be out there picking in the fields. And then if you think about people in Miami, for example, in lower income communities, you know, a lot of people can't necessarily afford air conditioning, or they can't afford it all the time. And they may not live in places where it's safe to have their windows open at night. And so it's already hot here. And as it gets hotter and hotter, that has serious health consequences. And, you know, falling from health consequences, that's a cost to everyone here in a lot of cases. If you know, you're on a low income, you're maybe on Medicare or Medicaid, that costs everyone.
Right. And at what point do people start voting with their feet? Do they flee for a slightly cooler state, a slightly less vulnerable state? Certainly the economic impact of people migrating out of Florida rather than coming in will be felt. That will be an economic hit that city officials, business leaders will have to manage and deal with. And if you're just tuning in, it's the Florida Roundup. As we talk statewide about the new climate assessment released by the government last week and how it's affecting Florida, as we look at everything from sea level rise to more hot nights, stronger hurricanes, the effects on agriculture, tourism, fishing. We're taking your calls and tweets. Tweet us at Florida Roundup. Give us a call at 305-995-1800 as we devote the full hour to this critical topic on the show this Friday here on the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Let's go to Jay in Crystal River. Hi, Jay. You're on the air.
Good afternoon, guys. How are you doing?
Great, thanks. Go ahead.
I wonder if people or even scientists have paid attention to the deforestation that's going on throughout the state of Florida. Right now, right here in north central Florida, I mean, we're going through Withlacoochee State Forest, you know, just to make an extension of the turnpike, and it's just a massive amount of trees being cut down. Wonder how much of an effect does that have with, you know, harder days or even to sustain hurricane damage to either sites or newer construction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Here.
Okay. Dr. Kurtman, what about that question from Jay?
So land use, we call it land use, land cover change, is a very important part of the climate change puzzle. And you can imagine if you deforest massive parts of the state, that will actually contribute to the warming, because you know now you have you don't have all that greenness that tends to be cooler than, say, concrete or asphalt. The other thing is that you know all of that biology is a carbon sink, and you no longer have that carbon sink, so that becomes again another positive.
Meaning it absorbs carbon.
Absorbs carbon. Yeah. Thank you. So you no longer have all that plant absorbing carbon. So the land use, land cover change is a critical part of the climate puzzle. So the caller's right. This is something we should be concerned about.
Kate and Amy, I know there are some communities in South Florida, at least, that have kind of canopy requirements for homeowners, where if you take down a tree for one reason or another, you've got to replace it with something that is at least the same type of canopy or same size of canopy.
Right. And here in Miami-Dade County, there's an initiative called Million Trees Miami, where they're trying to plant a million trees, I think, by 2020. And the idea is to reduce some of the heat impacts with what's called like an urban heat island effect, which is basically where you have a lot of concrete, not a lot of shade, it gets hotter. To what we were talking about before of not having a statewide strategy for climate change, I think there's a lot happening on the local level that, you know, maybe the state could learn from, related to just things that also, you know, are good investments to make property values.
And
go
Amy
up.
Green in Orlando, one of those is the city of Orlando wanting to become the most environmentally friendly, economically and socially vibrant communities in the nation. How's it going to do that?
That's right. Orlando Mayor Buddy Dyer has joined on with 60 other mayors nationwide in embracing this goal of powering Orlando entirely with renewable energy by 2050. And this is an effort coordinated by the Sierra Club in Orlando. This will mean transitioning to other energy sources, especially solar, and it'll probably mean revamping our electric grid.
And how is the city finding the resources, the financial resource, the money to do it?
Well, this is a long-term goal. This is a goal that was established in 2050, so a few decades out. And so this is a goal that
they have some time.
This is a goal they're continuing to work toward.
Kate, any conversation in South Florida about this kind of goal for a local community government to say we're gonna be this conscious about our energy usage?
Well, I think that's part of the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Change Compact. A lot of the cities and counties in that are thinking about how can we be more energy efficient. And then also, you know, to individual property owners, there's this program called PACE, which is basically you go in and you get your property assessed to see where you're not being energy efficient. And if you have that assessment done, you know, it comes up with a bunch of ways where you could maybe save money as you transition towards things like solar panels or making your house hardened against hurricanes or, you know, keeping the air conditioning inside by sealing up your windows better.
We'll talk
still
more
an individual about, decision, though, yeah.
Yeah, we'll talk more about what Floridians can do to try to reduce the impact of climate change and also an effort to put a price on carbon in the United States as the Florida Roundup continues after this. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
An updated federal government report released a week ago warns that cities in the southeastern United States are, quote, particularly vulnerable to climate change compared to cities in other regions, end quote. That means us here in Florida, where Ron DeSantis ran and won the governor's race on a platform that included the environment. We're getting so many tweets about this on the show right now, talking about the government piece. Here's one from Kathleen. She says, I used to work at the UF Water Institute in climate and water issues. What makes science so complex is our feedback loops, which make the effects of climate change irreversible. It's hard to explain to policymakers, she says. They think in the past, if you had polluted water, you could clean it later. If a forest was destroyed, you could replant it. This idea of irreversible and global change is very new. Now, Governor Rick Scott's administration, of course, was notorious for banning state environmental officials from using terms like climate change or global warming in their official communications. Lieutenant Governor-elect Jeanette Nunez says incoming Governor DeSantis will not have a similar policy.
I will tell you that Ron DeSantis is committed to looking at things from a very scientific, evidence-based practice. And so there's not going to be a prohibition on a word or on a concept or on an issue.
Nikki Fried, meanwhile, will be the only Democrat in the Florida cabinet. She is the incoming Commissioner of Agriculture.
Climate change is a reality, and I think step one is recognition of it. This didn't happen overnight, and this didn't just happen by chance. This is something that is man-made, a lot of these issues, so that means that we need man solutions.
This week, three Florida congressmen, two Democrats and one Republican among them, introduced legislation on Capitol Hill that would put a price on carbon emissions in the United States, a key contributor to climate change. So this is where we're at in our conversation about the National Climate Assessment and Florida. 305-995-1800. Lots of phone calls. Ben Kirtman is along with us, professor at UM's Rosenstiel School for Marine and Atmospheric Science, and two of the state's best environmental reporters, Kate Stein from WLRN, Amy Green from WMFE. Kate, first of all, let's tackle this piece of legislation. What would it do as written?
So this is called a carbon fee and dividend bill. At this point, it's a bill. And basically, how this would work is there would be a fee imposed on people, companies that create products that have the potential to release carbon dioxide. So that's like oil refineries, you know, petroleum producers, coal companies, that sort of thing. They'd be asked to pay a fee per ton of carbon emissions.
They'd be required to pay a fee under this legislation.
Yeah, not asked, yeah. Required. And then the money from that fee would be redistributed to taxpayers as a dividend. Basically, the assumption is that, you know, as the prices of, fee is implemented, the prices to the companies would raise their prices, and the taxpayers would be asked to, you know, pay a little bit more for their gasoline, for example. The idea of having a dividend paid back to them is that they'd be able to offset some of those costs.
So it would cost more in consumption costs, but yet you would get a dividend at the end of the year, some kind of like check, as if you're a shareholder of the United States. Similar to how Alaskans get a check if oil production and oil prices are high enough coming from their state.
Right. You'd get a dividend. And we heard earlier from Governor-elect DeSantis talking about how, to him, you know, dealing with climate change, at least in 2014 when he said this, mm-hmm. dealing with climate change means higher taxes that unfairly impact people who are poor. One of the selling points of this carbon fee and dividend plan is that, you know, everyone gets the same amount of tax rebate or same dividend as a taxpayer. And so people who are poor stand to benefit more than the wealthy.
And you're listening to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Dr. Kirtman, something she just touched on, climate change, whether it's in Florida or anywhere in the world, tends to affect marginalized communities the most. People with means, resources, and options, they will be able to do something about their situation. For example, here's a tweet from Dan, a listener. He says, I'm just going to move out of South Florida because of climate change and sea level rise. You know, not everyone is in a position to move or to mitigate their home or their place of work. This brings into the conversation the notion of climate justice. And we're also getting tweets about that, how this becomes not just a policy issue, not just a public health issue, but also a social justice issue. And that isn't something that is laid out so much in a scientific report. But I'd like to get your thoughts about that piece of this and how that will affect the most vulnerable in Florida.
I'm very concerned about this question of climate social justice. And I think that when we start to think about the communities that are going to be hit hardest by those warm nights or sea level rise or persistent flooding, more vulnerable to increased hurricanes, whatever that is, we need to come up with holistic and long-term solutions. And I think that requires communities to start planning now for what the future evolution will be. There are obviously going to be some neighborhoods, some parts of our infrastructure that we're not going to be able to continue to invest, and that's going to displace people. And we need to figure out how we're going to do that in the most equitable way. People are going to have to live at higher elevation. People are going to have to live near public transportation. How are we going to do that? How are we going to make sure that the most vulnerable in our society are treated fairly in that process? Like you said, you know, the people that can will easily, you know, can afford to move, will easily move. And I think it's really important that communities, when we start thinking about how we're going to adapt to the changing climate we've already committed to, how are we going to manage that? That's a hard process.
And we're not seeing much discussion of it, frankly, even though the warnings are clarion calls at this point.
That's right. I don't see much discussion of that. And it, you know, in all honesty, part of the problem is, you know, you can't see the carbon in the air. You can't see the pollution. So it's hard for people to get their head around that this is a train coming at me and I've got to figure out how to solve this problem. And, you know, I almost feel like if I could see the carbon in the air, I wouldn't be working so hard to try to convince people that we need to.
But the discord, though, that we have here in Florida is, Kate Stein, as you've reported on and even described here today on this program, local and regional efforts toward adjusting and adapting to the results of climate change. And Amy Green, even the local result there in the city of Orlando, trying to address the contributions to climate change in the form of the carbon emissions from the power consumed by the municipality in Orlando. So, Amy Green, we are seeing and continue to see local and regional responses. And now this week, with this new federal effort to put what they call a fee on carbon in the waning days of this Congress, we'll see how much interest and how much attention it may get in the new Congress. But Amy, talk to us about kind of this regional versus state versus national attention that the issue gets.
That's right. I mean, in the absence of state and national leadership on the issue of climate change, you're really seeing local governments take the lead on this issue, and municipalities like the city of Orlando or Satellite Beach over on the Space Coast, which is doing a lot of planning. New Smyrna Beach, I think, has started to do some planning as well. You're seeing local governments really take up the ball and run with it at this point. We do need political leadership for sure at the state and national level. You know, issues like infrastructure and building for future climate trends versus past climate trends, you know, things like limiting emissions, that's going to take political leadership at higher levels.
And one interesting thing I think about all of this is that it's sort of become a grassroots type of effort in the state of Florida, where we had cities come together and then we had counties. Tampa Bay just started a regional resiliency coalition. And it's starting from the ground up, to Amy's point. And it's kind of top down now, a little bit more at least, as we hear about the National Climate Assessment. So it'll be interesting to see if, with the new administration coming in, the state of Florida does something to act on climate.
Yeah. Let's take one more quick call. It's Gregory in Vero Beach. Gregory, go ahead quickly.
Yeah, I wanted to ask the panel, as we talk about conservation and trying to stem the tide, Florida used to be underwater. I realize it was a long time ago, but back then, man was pretty much using stone tools. So,
and your question?
Why is it we believe this is man-made and that we can stem the tide of a natural cycle in our environment?
Well, because I think the climate assessment is resounding that the majority of climate warming is man-made. Dr. Kurtman, can you answer his question?
Yeah, I tell this very simple story. If you go looking back in the history of climate, going, say, 800,000 years back, the level of CO2 in the climate has gone somewhere around 200 parts per million by volume to about 300 parts per million by volume. And that transition between 200 and 300, that natural variability, took on the order of, you know, tens of thousands of years, 10,000 years or a few 10,000 years. What's happened since the 1900s is we've gone from 300 parts per million by volume to over 400. So in a little over 100 years, We've gone way out of bounds of what it's been in the past 800,000 years. So the caller's right. Yes, there was a time when Florida is underwater, and there's going to be a time again when Florida is underwater. But we're actually introducing a perturbation to the change to the climate system that is unprecedented in the last 800,000 years in its magnitude and how fast.
What took tens of thousands of years in terms of carbon into the environment has taken a century to replicate.
That's right.
And coinciding with the Industrial Revolution.
That's right.
And just rapidly going upward from there. So in the 30 seconds we have, Dr. Kurtman, could you wrap us up, direct people to look at this report? What's the quick takeaway as we conclude this hour?
The quick takeaway is the climate system continues to warm, and we don't have a lot of time. We need to start acting now.
Dr. Ben Kurtman is with the University of Miami. Kate Stein covers the environment in South Florida with our member station WLRN. Amy Green, thanks for your context and contribution as well at WMFE in Orlando. Great to have everybody on the program here today.
Thanks, Tom.
Melissa, a lot to chew
to
on
all
here,
three.
Certainly.
It's amazing, and it's so important for Florida, Tom, and I'm so glad that we devoted the hour to it. And so many calls and tweets shows people are definitely dialed into this, so we'll keep covering it. Meanwhile, that is our show today. The Florida Roundup, produced by WJCT Public Broadcasting in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Bridget O'Brien is our producer.
Jason Zabka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming, also our technical director for the program. Our Director of Radio Operations in Miami is Peter Meritz. Theme music is provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos. Find more at aaronlibos.com. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back next week.